We're starting part two of our five-part series on orthodoxy and society, which I mentioned. I'm stealing this all directly from this incredible document called The Basis of the Social Concept of the Russian Orthodox Church. And I explained last week that this document, while it's specific to the Russian Church, they created it in the year 2000 to address societal questions, the things the church was going through then. Even though it's particular to their context and some of it is limited, 90% of it you can apply to us. And I think it's perfectly valid document for the church anywhere to look at. So last week we introduced things a bit. The very basis of this document is the idea that the church is the living body of Christ and living in the world. And so that the body of Christ as Christ has to relate to that world. How does it relate to the society, to the world at large? That's the big question. So this document is an attempt to answer that. We talked last week about church and nation, and we spent some time talking about Israel, how Israel was the first nation kind of called out, but how every nation has its own vocation to be God's people. We talked about church, and by nation, we also said it's not just nation as we understand it, but like nationalities and ethnic groups. So it's broader than just nation. And we have church and state, which is specific, right? Because the state is like the government, the civil authorities. So we mentioned how all arrangements between the church and state are basically economia. You know, you do what works for the sake of the people and the gospel. We talked about real limits and real opportunities that each state can have in its relation to the church. Would you close the door for me, please? Yeah. And we talked, and now this week we're heading into three or four more other topics. Tonight we'll be looking at Christian ethics and the secular law, looking at the church and politics, and then church and labor, the idea of labor and work. And then finally, if we get there, we'll talk about the church and property. And then we'll turn to more like law and order type things like war and peace and crime and punishment next week. So let's just plow into it here. So Christian ethics, the word ethics means it's really a branch of philosophy that systematizes and categorizes concepts of right and wrong. So it's how does the church process right and wrong in the context of a society and the law? So I'm going to read here a bit from this document. First paragraph, God is perfection, therefore the world as created by him is perfect and harmonious. Life is observance of divine laws, as God himself is life endless and abundant. Through the original fall, evil and sin enter the world. At the same time, fallen man has retained the freedom to choose the right with God's help, the right way with God's help. This is what we believe in free will, right? This is what we affirm. In this effort, the observance of God's commandments asserts true life, but deviation from them leads to death and damage, as it is nothing else but deviation from God, hence from being and life itself, which is only found in him. Okay? So there we have it as an introduction. The distance between crime and punishment keeps man free on the one hand, and compels the reasonable and pious people to study the divine commandments on the other, in order to learn to distinguish between the right and wrong, the lawful and the unlawful. And the foundation of this right and wrong goes back to natural law, right? We believe that in man's heart is written some kind of divine knowledge, some kind of divine sense of right and wrong. So you go to every culture, I don't care where you go, doesn't matter if they're Christian or pagan or whatever, there's still a code everywhere. Where there's a sense of right and wrong in a way that's kind of determined and laws that apply to it. So, and we thank God for that. We Orthodox Christians celebrate that. That's what the Alaskans were affirmed in when missionaries came to them from Russia, right? They affirmed these things. Another paragraph. The law is called to manifest the one divine law of the universe in social and political realms. At the same time, though, any legal system developed by the human community, being as it is a fruit of historical development, carries a seal of limitation and imperfection. So there's no system of law, no system of historical government or custom or ethics that's going to fully encapsulate the gospel perfectly. We need to know that. However, if we look around, we can say the gospel should inspire our laws. And we as Christians should, as we participate in society, have that perspective guiding our views as we go forward. And yet, we have to remember, it's human behavior and actions that are the subject of legal regulation. So really, the law is trying to deal with our nuts and bolts of our life. And then we have our faith, which is guiding our interactions with that. But they're not the same thing. The law contains a certain minimum of moral standard and compulsory for all members of society. The secular law has as its test not to turn the world lying in evil into the kingdom of God. You can't make the world the kingdom of God, but to prevent the world from turning into hell. That's why there are laws, and that's why the church blesses laws. And this is why it's okay that the law isn't necessarily the church law, but it's not. We're not trying to remake man by law. We can't do that. We tried that in the Soviet Union. It failed. We tried to remake man, the new Soviet man. Total failure. Huge failure, okay? So, but we can see government as a way to limit the evil in the world. St. Basil the Great taught the people of Caesarea and Cappadocia this. He said, because of a few, disasters come upon the whole people. Because of the evil deeds of one, many taste the fruits. Ahab the king committed sacrilege, and all the chariots were defeated. Already Zimri committed whoredom with a Midianite woman, and punishment went to Israel. St. Cyprian of Moscow, a great hierarch in the Middle Ages, said, do not you know that people's sins fall upon the prince, and the prince's sin falls upon the people? So there's the idea that we have that as the people of God are in the world, when the society is corrupted and evil, the people of the church will suffer too as a result, because society is sick. And we can definitely assess certain societies are sicker than other societies. We can say that objectively. So in the olden days, you know, when you had a Christian monarchy, which wasn't perfect, we'll get to that question later, but you at least had the idea that the laws of God should inform the laws of man. You can't say that we have that philosophy nowadays, because we have a secular system. Of course, there are nods to God in our Constitution, providence, the Creator, these kinds of things. But there's sort of a light touch nowadays because of the secular separation of church and state, which was not the norm until about 300 years ago, really anywhere. In days of old, of course, things like adultery and sorcery were punished by law, right? Yeah. If you were an adulterer, you'd go to prison, perhaps. If you were a rapist, you'd be executed. If you were a sorcerer or a witch or magician, you know, you'd go to jail. You'd suffer some kind of penalty for that. But nowadays, we've separated these two things out, more or less. The document says, the fallen nature of man that has distorted his awareness does not allow him to accept the divine law in its fullness. In various periods, people have been aware of only part of this law. This is evident from the Gospel's talk of the Savior about divorce. Moses allowed divorce because of the hardness of the people's hearts. But it was not so from the beginning, because in marriage, a man becomes one flesh with his wife, making marriage indissoluble. So there's this sort of spiritual ideal. Yeah. And then there's the legal condescension coming down from that to make it livable and doable. Because not everyone's living according to the deepest law of God, right? Mm-hmm. Jesus says, if you look at a woman, it's like sinning. You know, we can't legislate that.
Yeah.
We can't.
What do you think about whether...
Let's see here. However, in the cases where the human law completely rejects the absolute divine norm, so we know that our human laws are, at their best, are never going to hit the divine ideal, because you can't legislate what's in one's head or heart. However, there's a new thing now. In the past, it seemed that the laws that were given were at least striving toward what the church taught. For instance, in Old England, the law about abortion was thus. A woman was, the church taught abortion is wrong, period, right? And the way they did it then was by taking medication that would make you sick, and
yes,
and you would abort the baby, you know, internally. However, the church said, if you do that, that's a sin. You have to go to confession and do penance for it. The church was clear about it. The law, apparently, English common law, said abortion is wrong. However, it's only criminal if you abort your baby after it's quickened, which means about roughly after the first 3 months. That's when you start feeling motion in the belly, right? That baby starts moving around. If you kill at that point, that's considered maybe a capital crime, a serious crime. Before that, you can do it, even though the church says it's wrong. That would be an example, though, of a law that affirms the basic Christian principle, right? That says that this is wrong and is in sync with the church, but the punishment maybe doesn't fit entirely. But nowadays, we have many laws that are in complete discontinuity with the church's teaching. For instance, on abortion, maybe on like gay marriage, and various other topics. We could probably list out many. We have a challenge now in that many of the laws of our land are polar opposite from what the church would teach us. So, in the church founded by the Lord Jesus, there is a special law based on divine revelation. This is called canon law. This is another topic. While other religious statutes are given to humanity as fallen away from God and can be essentially part of the civil law, the Christian canon law is fundamentally supersocial, meaning it's not contained in the social realm. It cannot be part of the civil law, though in Christian societies it can be a favorable influence on the moral foundations of law. So in the church we have canon law, which regulates everything from the question of marriages to who's eligible for ordination, to who, how the bishop should run the diocese, to how a parish should operate, to how authority operates in the church, to how fasting should be in the church, to how icons should be painted or made. So the canon law deals with all these kinds of questions, and there's tons of topics it takes up, and those are not laws for society, but they're certainly laws within the church that we want to try to keep. But even in the church, we have these laws, but in the interest of the Spirit, the bishop has the right sometimes to exercise what's called economy or economia, to relax the prescription of the law to some extent. Yes, sir?
Are the rules of the diocese, I thought I had heard somewhere that, for instance, a priest in the OCA can only be a certain age, and after that they're supposed to retire, maybe, or something.
I think that's
are those considered canons?
I think that's a Roman Catholic canon. The Roman Catholics have a doctrine now where the bishop has to retire by the age of 70.
Well, I was told our priest in Albuquerque, Father George, at the diocese that
I have to ask.
Or 75, that they're supposed to step down at that point. That's what
wow.
they said.
Well, of course, a priest would never be relieved of his priesthood unless he's
right.
Wrong.
He helped, but he
would not be pastor anymore. I don't think there's a problem with that, honestly. I think that's probably a fairly decent rule.
Yeah.
As long as the bishop can break it. And I know of many, many priests who are still operating after the age of 75.
Well, I did.
And I wish for their sake they weren't sole priests, because it's rough at that age. The Christian state traditionally has borrowed laws from whatever land it was in. So in the early church, they borrowed law from the Romans, and that impacted how the church viewed its own law. In Ethiopia, they adopted Ethiopian customs. In America, the way we structure our parishes here is impacted by our polity. We have parish councils that are stronger in America than any other country in the world, because we're Americans and we like that. And most of our leaders are accustomed to having people around them that are helping them do that work. And I'm frankly very grateful for that. Yeah. As a priest, I like a strong parish council. I also like a strong priest. You gotta have both, though. If you have both, you're fine. So yeah, no, it's good. I would point out to everybody, just a little FYI, if you want to see how the canon law is applied to our church in America, go on the OCA website and look up the statute of the OCA. We just revised the statute, and it takes canon law, and it actually mentions the councils in parentheses, but it takes it and makes like a constitution for our church. That's very structured. You can see how does our church operate, what are the principles that we use to run our church. And what I like about it is it definitely operates on the canonical principles, but the order of it is very American. And so you can see how the two systems are creatively interacting. And I think that's orthodoxy. That's what is one of the points here.
Yeah.
The church should have this effect on how we interact with law. One important idea that's really widespread in our culture in the 21st century, the idea of inalienable rights of the individual has become one of the dominating principles of contemporary sense of justice. The idea of these rights is based on the biblical teaching on man as in the image and likeness of God, as a true free creature. Man is free, so he has rights. St. Anthony of Egypt says this, "Examine what is around you and see that princes and masters have power over your body alone, but not over your soul. Keep this in mind," he says. "Why then, when they order you, say, to kill or do something wrong, unrighteous or harmful to your soul, it is not proper for you to obey them even though they torture your body. God has created you free and your soul to be self-ruled. It is free to do as it wills, good or bad." You have rights, he's saying. You have rights to act and decide because you're in the image of God. Now, as secularism developed, the lofty principles of inalienable rights turned into a notion of the right to the individual outside his relationship with God. In the process, the freedom of the personality transformed into the protection of self-will and into the demand that the state should guarantee a certain material living standard for the individual and family. In the contemporary systematic understanding of civil human rights, man is treated not as in the image of God, but as a self-sufficient and self-sufficing subject. Outside God, however, there is only the fallen man, we believe, who is rather far from being the ideal of perfection aspired to by Christians and revealed in Christ. For the Christian sense of justice, the idea of human freedom and rights is bound up with the idea of service. The Christian needs rights, we believe, so that in exercising them, he may first of all fulfill in the best possible way his calling to be in the likeness of God, as well as his duty before God and church, before other people, before his family, before his state and nation, and other human communities. So rights exist for us to facilitate our being truly human. This is why we have them, to glorify God, to be the people God made us to be. And the criticism here is that whenever rights become just something to promote my selfishness, we have a problem. Now, the other problem here is that secularism works for us as a minority because it gives us space to pursue our own self-interest, which we believe is serving God, right?
Yeah.
We believe that. I'm not endorsing. I don't personally believe in like a libertarian principle, like let's all be free to do whatever that we want to do. I don't like that at all. However, in America, that kind of freedom allows us to practice our faith. Mm. It also limits how we can impact the culture, though. You know, we say, well, we're post-abortion. They say, who cares? That limits my self-will. That limits my own ability to choose. And we say that's Christianity for you. But others would say, no, you're imposing this morality on us.
Yeah.
You know, and this is the challenge we face in a secular world. It cuts both ways, right? This is our challenge. Law is viewed as a human invention, a construction that is built by society to benefit itself and fulfill tasks defined by itself. Hence, any changes in law, if approved by society, are considered valid in this new form of human rights. The written law has no absolute basis whatsoever. This view gives validity to the revolution that rejects the laws of the old world, and thus in contemporary society, abortion is not believed to be murder. It is not legally such either. Apologists of the law believe that society can introduce very diverse standards on one hand and consider any law enforced to be legitimate by virtue of its very existence. So this idea in our legal system of precedence, you know, you establish a precedent that's a right. There it is. It's in the system now. It is not related to any morality. It simply is this a precedent. This is a unique feature of particularly Western law. I mean, English common law is very much that way, right? Roe v. Wade. You have a precedent. You stick with it.
Doesn't that go back to Justinian, though?
Well, there's a not everything. Just yes, yeah, no. But not exactly, though, because like in the Roman law, it was a codex, and the laws were all carefully laid out. In the English system, which has percolated outward a little bit, there are these rulings that are made that then form precedence in the law. that are outside. This is why Louisiana has its own legal system, because they're under the Code Napoleon still. And so our precedents in English law don't apply. There are no precedents inside Louisiana. Now, there are national precedents that come down from the Supreme Court that they have to abide by. But then it's encoded in their law. They have a totally different system based on the old codes of Justinian and Napoleon, Roman law. It's different. So,
Are there any differences between the OCA here in the United States on things and the Russian Orthodox Church as far as secular things, because things are a little different here than there?
Well, one of the things that this document takes into account is that in Russia, there's a close relationship between the state and the church than there is here. Mm-hmm. Because in their constitution of the Russian Federation is enshrined the special place of the Orthodox Church. We have nothing like that here. Right? We have explicit separation of church and state. Now, there it is somewhat separated, right? You don't have to be Orthodox to be president of Russia, but the values of the church are enshrined in their constitution. That's a different system. But it also isn't the system of autocracy in Tsardom, where the Tsar was literally crowned by the patriarch and was anointed and then taken into the altar where he communed as a deacon, symbolizing his diaconia inside the kingdom.
Yeah, I heard that. If the Tsar was crowned by the patriarch, but then that Tsar made the power grab and got rid of the patriarch, and there wasn't a patriarch for 150, 200 years, who was crowning the Tsars?
The Metropolitan of Moscow. The same right obtained after that.
I know a lot of people, like nowadays with Russia, I hear people, a lot of people believe that...
The Church of Christ, preserving her own law based on the holy canons, canon law, keeping within the church life proper, can exist in the framework of a very diverse legal systems, which she can treat with respect. So we can live in an autocracy, we can live under the Romans, we can live in America, we can live in Western Europe, we can live anywhere, okay? We don't have to have one type of system. That's important to say. The church invariably calls upon her flock to be law-abiding citizens, wherever they are, and to love their homeland. At the same time, she's always underlined the unshakable limits to which her faithful should obey the law. We may not violate the law of God in pursuit of the law of the land. If the law says kill, and we think that we cannot kill, we are called to say no. And I'm going to continue this here. In everything that concerns the exclusively earthly order of things, the church is obliged to obey the law, regardless of how far it is imperfect or unfortunate. However, when compliance with legal requirements threatens the eternal salvation of our people and involves an apostasy or commitment of another doubtless sin before God and neighbor, the Christian is called to perform the feat of confession, as in like being a confessor, for the sake of God's truth and the salvation of his soul for eternal life. He must speak out lawfully against an indisputable violation committed by society or state against the statutes and commandments of God. If this lawful action is impossible or ineffective, he must then take up the position of civil disobedience.
Oh, yes.
This is what the church's teaching is. So, turning to the church and politics, I'm going to start by reading the prologue here. In the contemporary state, citizens participate in the government by voting, usually. Most of them belong to political parties, movements, unions, blocs, and other such like organizations based on various political doctrines or views. These organizations, seeking to order social life according to the political conviction of the members, have as one of their goals to hold or reform power in the state. Exercising powers given to them by popular vote during elections, political organizations can participate in the work of legislative and executive power structure. So you vote and with the hope of getting your people in and impacting how the state operates. This is normal in the West, normal even in Russia, you might say. The presence in society of different, sometimes opposing political convictions and discordant interests generates political struggle, which is waged by both legitimate and morally justifiable methods, and methods sometimes contradicting the norms of the church. So we have to be mindful, are these immoral ways to participate or moral ways to participate? The church, according to God's commandment, has a task to show concern for the unity of her children and peace and harmony in society and the involvement of all the members in common creative efforts. So we're called to be active in society and even in politics, without compromising the sort of peace of the gospel that should govern all that we do. Like, to be stirred up with passions in a political environment is not the gospel. You know, being at a rally and losing your cool. Honestly, I'm speaking, I have it on, I don't care. I watched both Republican conventions and the Democratic conventions, and then both reminded me of like a Communist Party gathering. It felt like brainwashing both ways. Oh, I'm just saying. I was deeply disturbed by both of them. Uh-huh. You know? I could tell you more, but I won't with their, you know. Deeply disturbed. In the face of political differences, contradictions, and struggles, the church preaches peace and cooperation among peoples holding various political views. She also acknowledges the presence of various political convictions among her episcopate, her clergy, and lay people, except for such as lead to clearly actions contrary to the faith and the moral norms of the church. So we're entitled to a diverse range of political views. I don't like either main party, but I believe you could be a Republican in good conscience or a Democrat in good conscience. I would hope, though, that either way you'd say there are many things I disagree with. I've chosen this party, but I have, because there, I don't see any party that aligns. And if there were a party that aligned perfectly, I'd be kind of worried.
Oh.
Yeah, I agree, Alana. However, you know, they don't hold power. Yeah. So, you know, it is impossible for the church's supreme authorities and for the clergy, hence for the plenary of the church, to participate in any activities of political organizations and election processes as public support for running political organizations. You can't campaign for a politician as the church. You can't endorse a party. You can't endorse a political movement broad-based and say, the church speaks for this, or this speaks for the church. At the same time, bishops and priests and laity have the right to participate, and they should participate in voting and in dialogue about issues. We have a right to be and have a voice. But we need to make sure that voice is not merely partisan, and I believe that's where the church has made mistakes in the past. For instance, there was a group of bishops who were just unapologetically monarchist in the old days. Wow. They defended the Tsar to the very end because, you know, we anointed him, you know, we crowned him. It was like a sacrament, yeah. And therefore we're monarchist. And part of Rokor's identity was they're monarchists, you know, and therefore restoring the monarchy in Russia. Well, I mean, that's not necessarily bad, but that's not something that the church should be pushing.
No.
And that's why I think the church, for maybe all of its mistakes it made in Russia, after communism, it did make some good, it did not endorse. There was one monarch candidate trying to get the church's support, and the church said, no, you're free to pursue that if you want, but not with our help. We won't stop you. We won't discourage you or encourage you. And that was very wise.
Yes.
In church history, there are not a few cases when the whole church gave support to various political doctrines, views, organizations, and leaders. In some cases, the support was linked with the need for the church to defend her fundamental interests in extreme conditions of anti-religious persecution and the destructive and restrictive actions of the non-Orthodox and non-Christian power. In other cases, the support resulted from the pressure from the political structures and usually led to divisions and controversy within the church and the falling away of many of her peoples from the faith. Example, Tsarist Russia. The church was so in bed with the state that many dissidents who hated the Tsar hated the church as well. And if you were a priest, you're an agent of the state. Your salary was paid by the state. And, you know, you had a loyalty pledge to the Tsar, which isn't necessarily wrong to pledge to support your government, but it became an ideology, you know. Similarly, in the Soviet times, there were some priests who were anti-Soviet on the basis of the fact that, well, this is anti-Christian, I should be anti-Soviet.
Yeah.
I can understand that. And we wouldn't judge someone who took that position. However, also in the Soviet times there were priests that sided with the Soviets because they knew they'd be killed otherwise. Mm-hmm. And they had to support, they made statements supporting the Soviet state, mm-hmm. which we would view as morally iffy at best.
Yeah.
But the point here is there are always these extreme circumstances where things happen on the edges and you just cross yourself and move on. They're not ideal.
Do you think it's wrong to be anti-Soviet in that position?
I think it was stupid to be anti-Soviet because what happened is there were some priests that were so anti-Soviet that The idea came to, in the mind of the Soviet leaders that the church was fundamentally, irrevocably opposed to the Soviet government.
I know that's why they killed the Christians, because they thought the church was inherently anti-Soviet.
Right, right. And so some of the other priests and bishops were anxious to show that, no, you could live in the Soviet Union and not hate the state and be a Christian. And some of them probably found a good balance. Others went too far. I think St. Tikhon, he had a good balance. He spoke against some of the evils of the Soviet state, but said his job was to pray for the civil authorities and to support the civil authorities, since we're supposed to pray for the emperor, pray for the king. That was his, he followed a very strict logic there, but he was killed for that.
Yeah.
You know, well, he was too reactionary.
Basically what I'm asking is, in a situation like the Soviets, if the making, you shouldn't break the law just for fun, but you have to if it goes against Christianity. But what if it's an anti, the Soviets banned Tolkien's books? Would it be wrong to break that law if you're a Christian? Because it's a stupid law and they're gonna kill you anyway.
Honestly, I think there's questions of tactics there, and tactics. There's
that
always
makes sense.
Tactics are always pliable. You know, but one of the things I've learned as a priest, when I first became Orthodox, I thought everything was black and white.
Yeah.
In fact, it's, pardon the phrase, shades of gray.
Yeah.
You know, things are really murky at times.
Yeah.
For example, in the 1970s, there was the president of Cyprus was Archbishop Makarios of Cyprus. He ruled Cyprus as almost the absolute ruler of Cyprus. You know why? I'm not justifying it, but this is interesting. Under the Turks, they had no leaders risen up. There were no natural leaders among the Greeks. Who was the one person that could unite all the factions together and have respect? It was the bishop. And so they elected him. They acclaimed him president. I believe he's the first president of a free Cyprus. And he ruled Cyprus as the president for many years. And he could keep the factions together. You know, is that wrong? Well, the canons forbid a priest, unequivocally forbid a priest from running for political office or being a magistrate. Why? Because as a magistrate, you must punish, you must exert control, you must command the military, potentially do violence, you must execute sentences, perhaps, put people in jail, you know, wage police action to save people. These are things that are incompatible, not only with being a priest, but incompatible, honestly, with being a Christian.
Yeah.
That's why Christians like Ambrose weren't baptized, because they couldn't be a Christian in those days and wield civil authority. That, you know, violence, perhaps.
Okay.
So, but anyway, there are always exceptions to the rule, like that one. In the 90s, there were a number of priests in Russia who were, as the communist government collapsed, there were priests who were respected in their dioceses, and the people loved them, and they claimed them representatives to the Supreme Soviet. And they went. And initially with the Patriarch's blessing, but later, as they got too political, the Patriarch had to withdraw the blessing.
Uh-huh.
And now there's a very strict rule. If you're a priest or bishop, you cannot serve in the civil authority at all.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the canonical rule anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, I can't run for mayor here, just so you know. In 1997, the Council of the Russian Church resolved, in a statement on relations with state and society, it resolved the following: to welcome the church's dialogue and contacts with political organizations, if such contacts are not endorsements of those organizations. That's good. Another thing, to consider it admissible to maintain cooperation with these organizations in tasks beneficial for the church and the people, unless this cooperation is construed as political support. And then thirdly, to consider inadmissible the participation of bishops and clergy in any election campaign or the memberships in political associations whose constitution provide for the nomination of their candidate to elective office on all levels. So you can be involved, for instance, in almost like a political advocacy group. Like if you want to give to the pro-life organization, I can go to a pro-life dinner and I can support that, because it's they're not nominating people to run for office. You know, I can go and, you know, I could go lobby for sexual rights or non-rights. What But I can't say I'm a Republican and I approve this message and I endorse and we're putting St. Athanasius behind this person. We can't do that. And fortunately, the law reflecting old Christian norms reflects that still. Right. The law still doesn't permit pastors to endorse from the pulpit, which is a testimony to how Christian some of our older laws are. Another one like that is the law about taxation. And this is mentioned in the document here, that one of the oldest laws of the church is that the donations and offerings of the people of God are not taxed. So they're given to the church, and the church pays no taxes on that.
There are a bunch of people nowadays who believe churches should pay be taxed.
Well, guess who instituted no taxes for churches?
Who?
St. Constantine. That was one of his first rules. And the bishop said, according to our theology, our offerings to God are offerings to God alone. We must give him all that we offer. And the bishops paid taxes on what they got. If they made money, they'd pay taxes themselves. But the money that went to the church was not taxed. And St. Constantine was the first to institute that. And since then, that has been untouched in all societies. I think even the Soviet Union had the same rule. Go figure.
Wow.
I mean, they took all kinds of stuff from the church. But I don't think the church paid taxes formally.
No.
Which is amazing. So
I don't know if this is in danger of happening, but I know there are a bunch of people who think the justification for churches being taxed is they see mega churches and
sure.
they feel like they're not
right.
really serving God.
Right, right. And that feeds into the anti-Christian narrative.
It does.
Nothing can prevent the Orthodox laity from participating in the work of legislative, executive, or judicial bodies and organizations. This involvement can take place under various political systems, such as autocracy, monarchy, constitutional monarchy, various forms of republican systems like ours. The participation of Orthodox people in civic and political processes was difficult only in the context of non-Christian rule during, like, communism, right? That's sort of difficult. In participating in government and political process, the Orthodox laity are called to base their work on the norms of the gospel's morality, the unity of justice and mercy, the concern for the spiritual and material welfare of all people, the love of their country, and the desire to transform the surrounding world more into the image of Christ. At the same time, the Christian politician or statesman should be well aware that in historical reality, and all the more so in the context of today's divided society, most decisions adopted and political actions taken tend to benefit only a part of the society, while restricting or infringing the interests and wishes of many others. Many decisions and actions are stained with sin or connivance with sin. Precisely for this reason, the Orthodox politician is required to be very sensitive spiritually and morally. You know, it benefits others, right? Think of Goldman Sachs, or, you know, think of all these organizations that we can get in bed with. Political action committees that dole out millions of dollars. These things can easily corrupt. And, you know, we lend our ear to certain interests as politicians, and before you know it, they're controlling you. This is the story of almost every politician in America. Most of them begin as good people. They begin as moral men and women who have real value. I mean, at least in their own paradigm, they have their own value hierarchy of values, right? Love of country, interest in the people, etc. Before long, though, they've been bought out by the NRA or by environmental groups, you name it. I'm not trying to pick on right or left. It doesn't matter. They buy you out, and then if you don't vote their way, they take your funding from you, and you won't get reelected, and you lose your seat, and you're game over. So you get sucked into these things where you have to vote according to what these interests are. And that's the point here. When we fall in that trap, we become insensitive to real needs. I'm shocked at... There's some really common sense legislation. I'm speaking practically now. This is me talking about an issue, not about a political party. There's some common sense laws about guns, like, you know, that I think is probably good legislation about gun control. Moderate, most gun owners support it, but the NRA refuses to let it be heard, and so they're threatening all the Congress members to yank their certification if they don't support the NRA line.
Wow.
And so they're ignoring the interests and the cries of millions of Americans.
Yeah.
To get the support of this one organization. And I don't hate the NRA, but, like, that's a problem. And that's endemic in our politics, I think.
I thought a different spin on this problem where For instance, Mario Cuomo's speech in the 90s, I think it was, they call it giving political cover to Catholic politicians. Well, I'm personally opposed to, for instance, abortion.
Right.
But as a legislator,
right,
you know, I vote for the will of my people, or I vote on these
right.
things that are
right.
best for the nation.
Right.
I personally wouldn't do this.
Right.
But I'll vote this other way.
Sure.
What is the church's responsibility come to the chalice?
Right.
I know the Catholics are wrestling
yeah.
with that. It's like, okay, this person has publicly voted for something that the church is very publicly against.
Yeah. No, this is a real problem.
Yeah.
Because, full disclosure, most Orthodox, of the 10 or 12 Orthodox believers in Congress, I think all but two of them are pro-choice on paper. Now, I don't know what they are personally. No, but you know, it's like John Kerry and Joe Biden. You know, they're in a church. They're both Catholics, right? But they're in a pro-life church, and they both say things to the effect that they hate abortion. They think abortion is bad, but they're not gonna oppose it legally. It's a very, I mean, it's a position I think is wrong.
Yeah.
I'm not, but as a priest, would I deny someone can be? Would I deny Senator, whatever her name is, Olympia Snow, I think she's Orthodox. Would I deny her communion because she's not as pro-life?
Jill Biden has recently publicly stated her support for certain pro-abortion measures, which seems to me like she's tread the other side of the line there rather definitely. But
right.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm pro-life. I believe abortion is morally wrong. But I know a lot of people who are pro-choice and think it's okay. And basically, I don't know where I stand as far as legislative. Well, I'm not convinced. Like, I've probably been brainwashed by them, but basically, at least they act like, okay, if you're against abortion, you want to lock women who have abortions up in jail, so you're locking, like, a desperate, impoverished rape victim in jail, and you evil.
Well,
no, nobody's
doctor.
Trying to punish.
Yeah.
Right now, there's
no
punishment.
No,
there's no.
I think if you say abortion is murder, then it should be, you mean you want it to be punished as murder in the court instead
well,
of saying,
well, interestingly enough, even in the Old Testament, Bethany, abortion is not punished as murder.
That's
it's a lesser punishment in Leviticus or wherever it is. I forget where it is. But that's in the Bible. It's a lesser punishment than murder.
I'd like to see more restrictions on the abortion doctors.
Well, the broader question is, what do you do with politicians? Can you give them communion? That I would ask my bishop that question,
yeah.
honestly, because, and I, part of it, I think, depending on the heart of the person. I would not rush to ban someone communion in any regard. I think there's only been a handful of times I've ever asked someone not to come to communion in my entire preaching. I've never done it publicly. I've never done it to shame them.
Wow.
But what I would do is I'd want to know the person, and I'd ask them, you know, in a confession, why do you support this? You know, and I don't know what I'd do, but I certainly would want to know the person. It's always personal, right? Our faith is always personal. I'd want to know them. I'd want to not make it I don't want to make it a political thing, right? Like, oh, I'm going to make a stand against this person because he's, you know, no, I'm a pastor. I'm not interested in making a political stand.
You know what's funny, Father, is we're against, I mean, it's pretty obvious, abortion, but we do accept contraceptives. And really, that's not natural.
Right.
Right?
We'll deal with that.
The real process,
We have a whole abortion section here coming up.
Okay.
Well, reproductive rights and stuff. And we'll talk about contraception and abortion in about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Let me wrap up. I'm almost done. I want to make sure I get through it here. Let's see. Laity who participate in the public political activity do so individually, not as the church. It's important to that. If Senator so-and-so, who's Greek Orthodox, is involved in politics, he or she's doing it as Senator so-and-so, who is also Orthodox, but never as the Orthodox. We can't have an Orthodox church party. We ought not ever have that. We can also note, too, final point, the organization of the Orthodox Christian should not have the nature of a secret society ever. presupposing one's total subjection to the leaders and conscious refusal to disclose their essence when consulting the church authorities and even making confession. The church cannot approve of the participation of her people, and more so the clergy, in non-Orthodox societies of this kind, since by their very nature, they divest a person of his total commitment to the Church of God and her canonical order. What would be a good example of this? What can't Orthodox Christians do?
Masons.
Can't be Masons, right? You know, everyone know what Masons are? Secret society?
Well, what, I don't
think
they
do.
When I was,
they worship Satan, or that's an hyperbole.
They do not worship Satan.
It doesn't matter.
Out of that,
is he a Mason?
Yeah.
Oh, it's forbidden to be a Mason, Orthodox. I'm surprised he's a Mason.
I'm surprised that they say that. I mean, my grandfather and all that were Masons. My grandma went.
My great uncle's a 33rd degree Mason.
Yeah, you know what I mean. But they weren't bad people, and they didn't do anything. So where does that come from?
The idea.
Let me say
the idea of the secret society is that it is a parallel structure to the church, and our final allegiance as Christians must be to God and the gospel. And the thing is, you cannot disclose as a Mason what happened in the Masonic meeting, what they really believe. They have these secret sort of ideals, which may or may not be godly. I don't know. They might be perfectly fine. Honestly, I really don't know anything about Masonry. My uncle, I love him. He's a very sweet man. I have no reason to believe he worships Satan. I don't think he does. But there's no way to verify that. And any political or social organization, for example, the Nazi Party, they had a hierarchy. You had to adhere to order. You could not, you know, some of these authoritarian groups have the same ideology. That competes with the gospel. And as Orthodox Christians, we ought to have nothing compete with the gospel on an ideological level. It's the gospel. So the church...
Well, I mean, what's the difference?
If you tell Charles that Satan worship, he'll snort.
I mean, I mean, you look at all the stuff. You know, I used to give speeches, like, at the Masons' lunches and stuff.
Right, right.
They're out there raising money.
For the kids.
Care for kids. And So what, I mean,
well,
I just...
I'm not saying...
I'm not sold on...
I'll be honest with you. I'm not saying... that I wouldn't even give money to the Shriners Hospital. I think I probably have no problem with that.
Right.
But as an Orthodox believer, I cannot be a Mason because of the question of dual loyalty. So in the past, have you heard of the Knights of Columbus?
Yeah.
Have you heard of AHEPA, which is the Greek version of that? AHEPA is the Greek Knights of Columbus. These are organizations that were concocted during the Golden Age of Masonry to compete with the Masons, because all of our people, Orthodox and Catholics, were joining the Masons. It was a Protestant organization, right? It's Protestant. You could be Jewish or Muslim or Protestant, but not Orthodox or Catholic. And so they created these organizations to draw our people back from the Masonry. And so they had their own kind of Catholic society, or Orthodox Greek society.
Oh, yeah.
But that's how big a temptation it was for many of our people. We had to have our own organizations to stop the Masons. Not the Masons are... I'm not saying they're bad, but what I'm saying is it's a competing system.
What's the difference? Why is it okay to do that then?
Because those aren't secretive.
Because they're not secretive.
So you can verify their knowledge.
Well, that makes sense. It's like, okay, suppose I was in this other group and I had a vow of secrecy, and whatever I did, I couldn't take it to confession without breaking my vow to that group.
So
I mean,
yeah.
That's what the issue is.
Are there? I'm gonna hold off on labor and its fruits and property till next week, and then we'll go into War and Peace and Crime and Punishment too. Hopefully, are there any questions for me before we deconvene?
A little struggle going back to the question about the public servant who is doing something, supporting something publicly that is against the church's teaching.
Yeah.
According to the teaching of the gospel, we confront an erring brother privately.
Right.
And we try to restore them to the faith, which is all well and good. And then if they aren't restored, you take two or three others, and then take them to the church and put them out if necessary. Well, in the case of a public servant who is very publicly stated for a position, if the priest or someone confronts them and reteaches them and they are repentant, this is all private. But their public statement is still out there. Is there an appropriate place for the penance to include a contradictory public statement?
I think that would. I think yes. I think that could be. But I also think that'd be something the priest, any kind of public penance that is put on a person should only be done in Orthodoxy with the blessing of the bishop, period. Mm-hmm. Private penances can be done with the priest and penitent, but if it's public, it has to be with the bishop's blessing.
It just seems really harmful to me to let someone come to the chalice when what everybody knows of them is flagrant sin.
Right.
Because that can be harmful to the image of the church. This person's been flagrantly opposed to the church, and now you're communing them.
Right.
That's a scandal.
Right.
And
I'm going to go off the record here.